or to rob. Community life pivoted around the holy laws, the synagogue, and the rabbi, who was at once teacher, spiritual leader, judge, and administrator of the community. The rabbis of the Pale were all great scholars. Their wisdom was far-reaching, and their authority rarely questioned. Within the ghetto, the Jews organized their own government under the overall leadership of the rabbis. There were 100 different lay offices and wardenships. There was a score of biblical and Talmudic societies. There was an organization for the care of orphans and a society to pay the dowries of the poorer girls. There were societies to care for the sick, the aged, and the lame. There were administrators of marriage contracts and an elected synagogue summoner, as well as a dozen other synagogue posts. There was an ecclesiastical court. There were psalm readers and administrators over the ritual baths. Indeed, the community moved as one for the existence of all. The poor donated to the poorer, the poorer to the poorer yet. Charity was the 11th, the unwritten commandment. Leading scholars and religious leaders had to be cared for. Nothing was allowed to interfere with the pursuit of wisdom. Many people said that Simon Rabinsky, the bootmaker, was second in wisdom only to the rabbi himself. In the Pale, where nearly everyone was destitute, the measure of a man's wealth was his knowledge. Simon served as a deacon of his synagogue. Each year he was elected to one or two other high offices in the community. It was Simon's dream to fill his sons with the wonders of the conquest of the mind. Jews called their Talmud a sea. They claimed it was so vast that one could read it and study it for a lifetime without ever looking at another book and never swim from one side of the sea to the other. The Rabinsky brothers studied this great collection of laws and customs, which contained information on everything from social behavior to personal cleanliness. In addition to studying the Talmud, the Rabinsky brothers spent hours learning the Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses, which make up the Torah and were considered the holiest of all works. They learned the Bible. They learned the oral laws of the Mishnah. They learned the folk legends, wise sayings, and commentary on the Bible of the Midrash. They learned the Kabbalah, the Book of Mystics, and they learned the prayers and songs and customs and holidays. Yossi and Yaakov studied the great post-Talmudic scholars, Moses Maimonides and Rashi. Although the Rabinsky family lived a grim existence, it was not entirely a life without hope or joy. There was always talk and debate, a tempting scandal to discuss, or a wedding, or a death, or a confirmation, or a birth to celebrate. There were the holidays to look forward to. The matchmakers were constantly busy. And there was the Sabbath. On one night each week, Simon Rabinsky and every other ghetto Jew became a king. The traditional horn would sound in the ghetto, and Simon would lay down his tools and prepare for his day with God. How he loved the sound of the horn! It was the same sound that had called his people to prayer and to battle for 4,000 years. Simon would go to the ritual bath while his good wife Rachel lit the Sabbath candles and recited a benediction. He would dress in his Sabbath finery, a long black silk coat and a beautiful fur-rimmed hat. He would walk proudly to synagogue with Yossi on one arm and Yaakov on the other. At home there was traditionally a family poorer than his in to share the Sabbath meal. Over the candles and the blessed bread and wine, he spoke a blessing and a few words of gratitude to God. Rachel served stuffed fish and noodles and chicken broth, and in the evening they would stroll through the ghetto calling upon the sick or receiving visitors in their shop, as they had no parlor. On Saturday, Simon Rabinsky prayed and meditated and spoke with his sons and reviewed their lessons and learnings and discussed religion and philosophy. As the sun set ending the Sabbath, Simon sang the song of the ghetto with Rachel, Yaakov, and Yossi. Rejoice to Israel, banish despair. With the day over, he returned to the realities of his bitter life. In the dingy cellar he called home and shop, Simon Rabinsky would crouch over his workbench in the candlelight, with his wrinkled hands drive a knife deftly through leather. Simon then said the same lament that had been said by Jews since their captivity in Babylon. If I forget thee, O Yerushalayim, let my right hand forget her cunning. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Yerushalayim above my chief joy. There was solace in prayer, and Simon Rabinsky was a believer among men. But even one so devout could not shut his eyes to the misery around and about him. How long, O Lord? How long? He would ask. How long must we live in this abysmal darkness? And then his heart would grow light, and he would become exalted as he repeated his favorite passage of the Passover prayer. Next year in Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem? Would it ever come? Would the Messiah ever come to take them back? Chapter 3 Yaakov and Yossi walked home from the seminary. Yossi's head was bowed. He was deep in thought, wondering about the meaning of certain passages of the Torah he had studied that afternoon. Young Yaakov danced around on his toes, flinging rocks at various objects in the street. He always carried a pocket full of rocks in case they ran into some bullies. As they approached the corner near home, Yaakov grabbed Yossi's wrist. There is going to be another meeting tonight in Hakohen's shop, he said. I heard all about it, Yossi said. Will you go this time? No. You should go tonight, Yaakov said. There is going to be a real Bilu from Palestine to speak. Yossi's heart pounded. A real Bilu from Palestine. How he would love to see and hear someone who had actually been to Palestine. Secretly, Yossi envied his younger brother, who had been sneaking off to Lovers of Zion meetings. His curiosity was aroused by this new organization which spoke of the defense of the ghetto and a return to the Holy Land. A real Bilu? No, he would not yield to temptation. Never so long as his father objected to the Lovers of Zion. They turned the corner and entered the shop, first kissing the mezuzah, a tiny prayer scroll nailed to the doorpost. The place smelled strongly of leather. Simon looked up from his workbench and smiled. Hello, Papa, they both said quickly, and drew a curtain over the alcove which served as their bedroom in one corner of the shop. Simon knew by their manner that they had been discussing something in secret, and he also knew full well what young Yaakov had been up to. But he did not say a word. The boys must have their fling, Simon thought. I will not impose my will on them in this matter, nor will I speak to them unless they speak to me first. Simon could be considered among the more fortunate Jews of the ghetto. His family was in good health, and he had a trade which allowed him to exist, however meagerly. The mortality rate of Jews in the Pale was more than twice that of the rest of the population of Russia. Not only the Jews were near starvation. Most of Russia, especially the peasantry, hovered on the brink of destitution. The country wallowed in the backwash of feudalism, refused to industrialize, and was exploited by the aristocracy. Bread, land, and reform movements sprang up all over the nation. Because their own plight was the worst, there were always Jews to be found in any organization which strived to alleviate the wretched conditions. Unrest mounted throughout Russia. An undercurrent which spelled revolution was brewing. Only then did Tsar Alexander II institute some long-overdue reforms. His first move was to free the serfs and he relaxed some of the stringent anti-Jewish statutes. The new laws even allowed a limited number of professional and artisan Jews to live in Moscow. In Bessarabia, a few Jews could purchase land. However, the reforms were mere crumbs. In trying desperately to divert the people's attention from the real issue of tyranny, the masterminds behind the Tsar found a new and convenient use for the old scapegoats, the Jews. Hatred for the Jew in Russia had been based on religious bias, ignorance, and superstition, coupled with the peasants' blind hostility due to their inferior status. The Russian government decided to make anti-Semitism a deliberate political weapon. They launched a campaign in which the number of Jewish members in the bread and land movements was exaggerated, and they claimed it was all a plot of Jewish anarchists out to seize the government for their own profit. It was furthered, as the Russian government secretly drummed up, sponsored, fostered, and condoned bloody pogroms in which ghettos of the Pale were sacked, the women raped, and blood flowed freely. As the mobs tore through the ghettos, the Russian police either turned their backs or actively engaged in the affairs. On March 13, 1881, an awesome catastrophe befell the Jews. Tsar Alexander II was assassinated by a rebel's bomb, and one of the convicted revolutionaries was a Jewish girl. This paved the way for years of horror. The power behind the new Tsar Alexander III was the sinister Pobyedonostsev. He handled the weak-minded new ruler like an infant. Pobyedonostsev regarded the principles of equality, bread, and democracy as extremely vulgar and set out to crush them ruthlessly. As for the Jews, Pobyedonostsev had special plans. As procurator of the Holy Synod, he received a silent nod from the Greek Church for his scheme, which called for the elimination of the Jewish population. One-third would go through government-sponsored pogroms, starvation, and other forms of murder. One-third would go through expulsion and exile. One-third would be converted. Easter week, 1881. The coronation of Tsar Alexander III was the signal to begin. Pobyedonostsev's pogroms erupted and spread to every city of the Pale. After the first outbursts, Pobyedonostsev quickly had a dozen laws enacted that either eradicated any previous gains made by the Jews or aimed to destroy the rest of the Jewish population. In the wake of the awful happenings of 1881, the Jews of the Pale groped desperately for an answer to their problems. 1,000 ideas were advanced, each more impractical than the last. In many corners of many ghettos, a new voice was heard by a group who called themselves Chovevei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion. Along with the Lovers of Zion came a document from the pen of Leo Pinsker, which seemed to pinpoint the causes and solution of the Jewish plight. Pinsker's document called for auto-emancipation as the only way out for the Jews of the Pale. Late in the year 1881, a group of Jewish students from Romney bolted from the Pale and made for Palestine with the motto on their lips, Beth Yaakov Lekuven Elka, House of Jacob, let us go up. This daring band of adventurers, 40 in number, became known far and wide by the initials of their motto, which in transliteration became the Bilu. The Bilus started a small farming village in the Sharon Valley of Palestine. They named it Rishon LeZion, first to Zion. The pogroms in the Pale increased in fury, reaching new heights of bloody destruction on Easter morning 1882 in the town of Balta. As a result, new groups of Bilus struck out for the Promised Land, and the Lovers of Zion grew by leaps and bounds. In the Sharon, the Bilus founded Petach Tikva, the Gate of Hope. In the Galilee, they founded Rosh Pinah, the cornerstone. In Samaria, they founded Zikron Yaakov, the memory of Jacob. By the year 1884, a half dozen small, weak, and struggling Belu settlements had been begun in the Holy Land. Each night in Zhytomyr and in every other city of the Pale, there were secret meetings. Youths began to rebel and to be diverted from the old ways. Yaakov Rabinsky, the younger of the brothers, was swept up in the new ideology. Often during the night he lay awake, staring into the darkness in the alcove of the shop he shared with his brother Yossi. How wonderful it would be to be able to fight! How wonderful to strike out and really find the Holy Land! Yaakov's head was filled with the past glory of the Hebrews. Often he pretended he fought alongside Judah the Hammer as the Maccabees swept the Greeks from Judea. He, Yaakov Rabinsky, would be there as Judah Maccabee entered Jerusalem and rededicated the temple. Yaakov Rabinsky would be there with Shimon Bar Giora, who held Jerusalem against the might of Rome for 18 long months. He would be there in chains alongside Giora as the proud Hebrew warrior was led off to Rome to the lion's den. Yaakov would be there with the greatest of them all, Bar Kokhba, the scourge of the Romans. He would be there at the stands at Herodium and Machaerus and Masada and Betar, where they fought the last man after several years of siege. And of all his heroes, Yaakov wanted most to be with Rabbi Akiva when he met his martyrdom at Caesarea. For Akiva was teacher, scholar, and fighter all in one. When the lovers of Zion came around to Zhytomyr, Yaakov ran off to the meetings immediately. Their message of auto-emancipation was music to his ears. The lovers of Zion wanted his brother Yossi because of his size and strength. But Yossi, out of respect for his father, as commanded by God, was slow to move toward these radical ideas. The day after the Belu from Palestine spoke in HaKohen's candle shop, Yossi could stand it no longer. He wanted to know everything from Yaakov, how the Belu looked, every word he said, every gesture. "I think, Yossi, the time has come for you to attend a meeting with me." Yossi sighed. It would mark the first time in his life he had openly gone against his father's wishes. "Very well," he whispered, and all that day asked forgiveness for what he was about to do. The brothers told their father they were going to say Kaddish, a mourner's prayer, for a friend who had recently died. They sped off to the shop of HaKohen, the candlemaker. It was a tiny basement shop like their own home. It smelled of wax and sweet scents. Curtains were drawn over the windows. Guards were posted outside on the street. Yossi was surprised at how many familiar faces he saw in the packed room. The speaker was a man from Odessa named Vladimir. Vladimir neither looked nor acted like them. He had no beard or side curls. He wore boots and a black leather jacket. As he began to speak, Yaakov became entranced, and around the room a half dozen hecklers started up. "Are you the Messiah who has come to lead us back?" someone called. "Did you find the Messiah under your bed when you hid during the last pogrom?" Vladimir rejoined. "Are you sure you're not one of the Tsar's spies? Are you sure you are not one of the Tsar's next victims?" Vladimir retorted. The room quieted down. Vladimir spoke softly. He reviewed the history of the Jews in Poland and in Russia, and then expanded his summary to include Germany and Austria as well. Then he spoke of the expulsions from England and France, then of the massacres at Bray and York and Spires and Worms. Vladimir spoke of how the Pope had called upon the Christians to regain the Holy Land from the Muslims, and of how five crusades over 300 years were directed against the Jews in the name of God. Vladimir spoke of one of the most horrible periods of all, the Spanish Inquisition, during which unbelievable atrocities against the Jews were committed in the name of the Church. Comrades, every nation on the face of this earth has derided us. We must arise again as a nation. It is our only salvation. Pinsker has seen it, and the lovers of Zion see it, and the Belus see it. We must rebuild the house of Jacob. Yakov's heart was pounding as the boys left the meeting.
See, Yossi? What did I tell you? You saw tonight that even Rabbi Lipzin was there.
I must think about it, Yossi said defensively. But even as he spoke, he knew that Vladimir was right, and Yakov too.
It was their only salvation. The street was quiet and dark, and they walked briskly. They reached their home, quickly kissed the mezuzah, and went in. A candle was burning on Simon's bench. He stood behind it in his long nightshirt, with his hands clasped behind him.
Hello, Papa,
they said quickly, and tried to duck into their alcove. Boys, Simon commanded. They walked slowly before his bench. Their mother walked into the room and squinted.
Simon, she said, are the boys home?
They are home.
Tell them they shouldn't be on the streets so late.
Yes, Mama, Simon said. Go to sleep, and I shall speak to them. Simon looked from Yakov to Yossi and back to Yakov. I must tell Mrs. Horowitz tomorrow that her husband can surely rest in peace because my sons joined in a minyan for him tonight. It was impossible for Yossi to lie to his father.
We weren't at minyan for Reb Horowitz, he mumbled.
Simon Rabinsky feigned surprise and held his hands aloft.
Oh, so. I should have known. You boys were courting. Just today. Abraham the matchmaker was in the shop. He said to me, Simon Rabinsky, he said, you have a fine boy in Yossi. Yossi will bring you a handsome dowry from the family of some very fortunate girl. Can you imagine? He wants to make a shidduch for you already, Yossi.
We were not courting, Yossi gulped.
Not courting? No minyan? Perhaps you went back to the synagogue to study.
No, father,
Yossi said almost inaudibly. Yakov could stand it no longer.
We went to a Lovers of Zion meeting.
Yossi looked up at his father sheepishly, bit his lip, and nodded red-faced. Yakov seemed glad it was in the open. He stood defiant. Simon sighed and stared at both his sons for a full 5 minutes.
I am hurt, he announced at last.
That is why we did not tell you, father. We did not want to hurt you, Yossi said.
I am not hurt because you went to a Lovers of Zion meeting. I am hurt because the sons of Simon Rabinsky think so little of their father, they no longer confide in him.
Now Yakov squirmed too.
But if we'd told you, he said, you might have forbidden us to go.
Tell me, Yakov, when have I ever forbidden you to pursue knowledge? Have I ever forbidden a book? God help me. Even the time you took the notion into your head that you wanted to read the New Testament, did I forbid that?
No, sir, Yakov said.
I think a talk is long overdue, Simon said.
The candlelight seemed to blend with the red of Yossi's hair. He stood half a head taller than his father, and now, as he spoke, he did not falter. Although Yossi was slow in making up his mind, once it was made up, he rarely changed it.
Yakov and I did not want to hurt you, because we know how you feel about the Lovers of Zion and the new ideas. But I am glad I went tonight.
I am glad you went too, Simon said.
Rabbi Lipzin wants me to sign up for ghetto defense, Yossi said.
Rabbi Lipson departs from so many traditions, I am beginning to wonder if he is a Jew, Simon said.
That is just the point, Father, Yossi said. You are afraid of the new ideas.
It was the first time Yossi had ever spoken thus to his father, and he was immediately ashamed. Simon walked around the counter and put his hands on his son's shoulders and led them into their alcove and bade them sit down on their beds.
Don't you think I know what is going through your minds? New ideas, indeed. There was exactly the same talk about auto-emancipation and ghetto defense when I was a boy. You are only coming to a crisis that every Jew comes to make your peace with the world, to know your place. When I was a boy, I even thought once of converting. Don't you think I know how he feels?
Yossi was astonished. His father had thought of conversion?
Why is it wrong for us to want to defend ourselves? Why is it made a sin by our own people to want to better our conditions?
Yakov demanded.
You are a Jew, his father answered, and being a Jew entails certain obligations.
To hide under my bed while people try to kill me? Don't raise your voice to father,
Yossi admonished.
No one said it is easy to be a Jew. We were not born on this earth to live from its fruits. We were put here to guard the laws of God. This is our mission. This is our purpose.
And this is our reward,
Yaakov snapped back.
The Messiah will come and take us back when he is good and ready, Simon said, unruffled. And I do not believe it is for Yaakov Rabinsky to question his wisdom. I do believe it is for Yaakov Rabinsky to live by the laws of the Holy Torah.
There were tears of anger in Yaakov's eyes.
I do not question the laws of God, he cried, but I question the wisdom of some of the men who interpret those laws.
There was a brief silence. Yossi swallowed. Never had anyone spoken so harshly to his father. Yet he silently applauded his brother's courage, for Yaakov was daring to ask the very questions he himself dared not ask.
If we are created in the image of God, Yaakov continued, then the Messiah is in all of us, and the Messiah inside me keeps telling me to stand up and fight back. He keeps telling me to make my way back to the promised land with the lovers of Zion. That is what the Messiah tells me, Father.
Simon Rabinsky would not be shaken.
In our history, we have been plagued with false messiahs. I fear you are listening to one of them now.
And how do I recognize the true Messiah?
Yaakov challenged.
The question is not whether Yaakov Rabinsky recognizes the Messiah. The question is whether the Messiah will recognize Yaakov Rabinsky. If Yaakov Rabinsky begins to stray from his laws and listens to false prophets, then the Messiah will be quite certain that he is no longer a Jew. I suggest to Yaakov Rabinsky that he continue to live as a Jew, as his father and his people are doing.
Chapter 4
Kill the Jews!
A rock smashed through the seminary window. The rabbi hurried the students out through the back to the safety of the cellar. In the streets, Jews scampered wildly for cover, ahead of a frenzied mob of over 1,000 students and Cossacks.
Kill the Jews! They screamed. Kill the Jews!
It was another pogrom, inspired by Andreev, the humpbacked headmaster of a local gymnasium, high school, and foremost Jew-hater in Zhytomyr. Andreev's students swaggered down the streets of the ghetto, smashing up storefronts and dragging any Jews they could find into the streets and beating them mercilessly.
Kill the Jews! Kill the Jews! Kill the Jews!
Yaakov and Yossi raced from the seminary. Using a route through back alleys, they sped over deserted cobblestone streets to reach their home and protect their parents. They ducked frequently for cover and worked away from the sounds of hoofbeats of Cossack horses and from the blood-curdling screams of the students. They turned the corner into their street and ran head-on into a dozen hoodlums wearing university caps, disciples of Andreev.
There go two of them!
Yakov and Yossi turned around and fled, leading the pack of pursuers away from their own home. The students howled with glee as they sprinted after the brothers. For 15 minutes they wove in and out of streets and alleys until the students trapped them against a dead-end wall. Yossi and Yakov stood with their backs to the wall, dripping sweat and panting for breath, as the students formed a semicircle and closed in on them. His eyes gleaming, the leader stepped forward with an iron pipe and swung on Yossi. Yossi blocked the blow and snatched up the student, spun him around, lifted him over his head, and hurled him at the rest of his companions. Yakov, whose pocket full of rocks was for just such occasions, bounced two stones off the heads of two students, sending them to the ground unconscious. The other students scattered in flight. The boys dashed home and flung open the door of the shop.
Mama! Papa!
The shop was a shambles.
Mama! Papa!
They found their mother cowering in a corner in a state of hysteria. Yossi shook her hard.
Where is Papa? The Torah! She shrieked. The Torah!
At that instant, 6 blocks away, Simon Rabinsky staggered into his burning synagogue and fought his way gagging to the end of the room where the Holy Ark stood. He threw back the curtains with the 10 commandments inscribed on them and pulled down the Sefer Torah, the scroll of the laws of God. Simon pressed the holy parchment against his breast to protect it from the flames and staggered back to the door. He was badly burned and choking. He staggered outside and fell onto his knees. 20 of Andreev's students were waiting for him.
Kill the Jew!
Simon crawled a few yards and collapsed, covering the Sefer Torah with his body. Clubs smashed his skull. Hobnailed boots ripped his face.
Kill the Jew!
In mortal agony, Simon Rabinsky screamed out,
Hear, O Yisrael! The Lord is our God! The Lord is one!
When they found Simon Rabinsky, he was beyond recognition. The Sefer Torah, the laws which God had given Moses, had been burned by the mob. The entire Zhytomyr ghetto mourned his passing. He had died in the noblest way a Jew could meet death, protecting the Sefer Torah. Simon was put to rest along with a dozen others who had been murdered in Andreev's pogrom. For Rachel Rabinsky, the death of her husband was but another tragedy in a life which had known little else but sorrow. But this time her strength and will were gone. Even her sons could not comfort her. Rachel was taken off to live with relatives in another town. Yossi and Yakov went to synagogue twice each day to say Kaddish for their father. Yossi remembered how his father had wanted to live as a Jew so that the Messiah would recognize him. His whole mission in life had been to protect God's laws. Perhaps his father had been right. Perhaps it was not theirs to live from the fruits of the earth, but to serve as the guardians of God's laws. In his sorrow, Yossi probed to find a reason for his father's brutal death. Yakov was different. His heart was full of hatred. Even as he went to say the mourner's prayers, his soul demanded revenge. He seethed and smoldered. He was restless and angry. He muttered time and again that he would avenge his father's death. Yossi, knowing his brother's state of mind, barely let him out of his sight. He tried to soothe and comfort Yakov, but Yakov was inconsolable. A month after the death of Simon Rabinsky, Yakov slipped from the shop in the middle of the night as Yossi slept. He took from his father's bench a long, sharp knife and hid it in his belt, and ventured from the ghetto toward the school, where Andreev, the Jew-hater, lived. Yossi awoke instinctively a few minutes later. The instant he saw Yakov was gone, he dressed hurriedly and ran after him. He knew where his brother would be going. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Yakov Rabinsky pulled the brass knocker on the door of Andreev's house. As the demented hunchback opened the door, Yakov sprang from the shadows and plunged the knife deep into his heart. Andreev emitted one short shriek and rolled to the ground, dead. A few moments later, Yossi rushed onto the scene to find his brother standing hypnotized over the body of the slain man. He pulled Yakov away, and they fled. All the next day and night, they hid in the cellar of Rabbi Lipsin's house. Word of Andreev's murder spread quickly throughout Zhytomyr. The elders of the ghetto met and came to a decision.
"We have reason to fear that you too were spotted," the rabbi said when he returned. "Your red hair, Yossi, was seen by some students."
Yossi bit his lip and did not reveal that he had only been trying to prevent the crime. Yakov showed no remorse for his deed.
"I would do it again, gladly," he said.
"Although we understand well what drove you to this deed," said the rabbi, "it cannot be forgiven. You may well have started another pogrom. On the other hand, we are Jews, and there is no justice for us in a Russian court. We have reached a decision you are to abide by."
"Yes, Rabbi," Yossi said.
"You are to cut off your curls and dress like Goyim. We will give you food and money enough to travel for a week. You must leave Zhytomyr at once and never return."
In 1884, Yakov and Yossi Rabinsky, aged 14 and 16, became fugitives. They used the roads only by night and hid during the day, moving east to Lubny, a distance of 100-odd miles from Zhytomyr. At Lubny, they found the ghetto immediately and sought out the rabbi, only to learn that their notoriety had preceded them. The rabbi and the elders of Lubny met and agreed to give the boys enough food and money for another week's travel. This time their destination was Kharkov, some 200 miles away, where the search for them might not be so intense. Advance word was sent to the Kharkov rabbi that the Rabinsky boys were on the way. The entire countryside was on the alert for the Rabinsky brothers. It took 20 days of cautious moving for them to get to Kharkov. Their fame had spread throughout the Pale, and their capture was being turned into a holy mission. For 2 weeks, they hid in the clammy basement beneath the synagogue in Kharkov, their presence known only to the rabbi and a few elders. At last, the rabbi Solomon came to them.
"It is not safe, even here," he said. "It is only a matter of time until you boys are discovered. Already the police have been prowling around asking questions. But, with winter coming on, it will be near impossible to move."
The rabbi sighed and shook his head.
"We have also tried to get you papers to enable you to travel beyond the Pale, but I am afraid that is impossible. You are too well known by the police."
He paced back and forth.
"We have decided there is but one thing to do. There are some Jewish families in this district who have passed as Gentiles and who own small farms. We feel it would be the safest plan for you to hide with one of them until spring, at least."
"Rabbi Solomon," Yossi said, "we are very thankful for everything that has been done for us. But my brother and I have made a plan of our own."
"What is that?"
"We are going to Palestine," Yakov said.
The good rabbi looked stunned.
"To Palestine? How?"
"We have a route in mind. God will help us." No doubt God will help you, but let us not press him for a miracle. It is over 300 hard, cold miles to the port of Odessa. Even if and when you reach Odessa, you cannot get a boat without papers. We are not going by way of Odessa. But there is no other way. We intend to walk.
Rabbi Solomon gasped.
Moses walked for 40 years,
Yaakov said.
It will not take us that long.
Young man, I am well aware that Moses walked for 40 years. That does not explain how you are going to walk to Palestine.
I'll tell you our plan,
Yossi said.
We will go south. The police won't be looking for us so strenuously in that direction. We will cross out of the Pale into Georgia, and then over the Caucasus Mountains into Turkey.
Madness! Insanity! It cannot be done!
Do you mean to tell me you will walk over 2,000 miles through the cold of winter, across strange lands and 15,000-foot mountain ranges without papers, without knowledge of the country, with the police after you? Why, you are but little more than children.
Yaakov's eyes were burning with passion. He looked at the rabbi.
Fear not, for I am with thee. I will bring thy seed from the east and gather thee from the west. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back. Bring my sons from far, and my daughters from the ends of the earth.
And so it came to pass that the Rabinsky brothers, who were wanted for murder, fled from Kharkov, and moved to the east and to the south, through an inhumanly bitter winter. They trudged through waist-high snow during the night, bending their young bodies against howling winds and fighting off the numbness of frostbite. Their bellies rumbled with hunger. They stole from the countryside, and in the hours of daylight, they hid in the forests. Through those tortured nights, it was Yaakov who filled Yossi with the spirit of their mission. It was Yaakov who urged another step and another, and yet another, when all strength was gone. It was Yossi with his powerful body who held his younger brother up. Between their two strengths, they somehow managed to keep alive and moving. Many a night Yossi had to carry Yaakov on his back for 8 hours, because the younger brother's feet were raw and bleeding, and he could not walk. Many a day Yossi had to sleep on top of Yaakov to pass his warmth on to his weaker brother. Often, they crawled the last few yards to a hiding place. Over the ice and the snow they staggered south, with but cloth wrappings around their feet, yard after yard, mile after mile, week after week. In the spring, they reached Rostov and collapsed. They found the ghetto and were taken in and fed and sheltered. Their rags were exchanged for new clothing. They had to rest several weeks before they were fit enough to continue the journey. Late in the spring they went on again, fully recovered from their winter's flight. Although they did not now have to contend with the elements, they had to move with greater caution, for they had left the Pale behind and could no longer depend on protection, food, and shelter from the Jewish communities. They skirted the Black Sea, south of Rostov, and moved deep into Georgia. All their food now was stolen from the fields. They never let themselves be seen by daylight. As winter came on again, they were faced with a tremendous decision. To hole up in Georgia, to try to get through the Caucasus Mountains in winter, or to attempt a boat across the Black Sea. Each plan had its dangers. Although trying the mountains in winter seemed the most foolhardy, their urge to leave Russia behind was so great that they decided to risk it. At Stavropol, at the base of the mountains, they staged a series of robberies, which completely outfitted them with clothing and food for the assault over the mountains. Then they fled into the Caucasus, toward Armenia, with the police on their track. Through another brutal winter, they moved deep into the mountains, walking by day, climbing the treacherous passes in the dark, and pillaging the countryside. The first year had hardened them and made them wise. The obsession to get to Palestine was greater than ever and drove them onward. Yaakov would babble passages from the Bible by the hour to drive their bodies forward. They made the last part of their push instinctively in a numbed daze. And in spring, they received their second miracle of rebirth. One day they stood up and for the first time breathed free air, as they left Mother Russia behind them forever. As Yaakov passed the border marker into Turkey, he turned and spat into Russia. Now they could move in daylight, but it was a strange land with strange sounds and smells, and they had no passports or papers. All of eastern Turkey was mountainous, and the going was slow. They went to work in the fields in places where they could not steal food, but twice that spring they were caught and thrown into prison briefly. Yossi reckoned they would have to give up thievery, for it was too dangerous being caught. They might be sent back to Russia. In the middle of summer, they passed the base of Mount Ararat, where the Ark of Noah had landed. They pressed on to the south. In each village they asked, "Are there Jews here?" In some there would be Jews, and they would be fed and clothed and sheltered and sent along their way. These Jews were different from any they had known. They were peasants filled with ignorance and superstition, yet they knew their Torah and kept the Sabbath and the holy days. "Are there Jews here?"
"We are Jews."
"Let us see your rabbi."
"Where are you boys going?"
"We are walking to the Promised Land."
It was the magic password.
"Are there Jews here?"
"There is a Jewish family in the next village."
Never once were they refused hospitality. 2 years went by. The brothers pressed on doggedly, stopping only when exhaustion overcame them, or they had to work for food.
"Are there Jews here?"
They pressed over the Turkish border into the province of Syria and another strange land. In Aleppo, they received their first taste of the Arab world. They passed through bazaars and dung-filled streets and heard Muslim chants from the minarets. They walked on until the blue-green of the Mediterranean Sea burst suddenly before them, and the howling winds and cold of the past years were exchanged for a blistering heat of 120 degrees. They plodded down the Levantine coast, wearing Arab rags.
"Are there Jews here?"
Yes, there were Jews. But again they were different. These Jews looked and dressed and spoke like Arabs. But yet they knew the Hebrew language and the Torah. Like the Jews of the Pale and the Jews of Turkey, the Arab-like Jews took the Rabinsky brothers in without question and shared their homes and their food. They blessed the brothers as they had been blessed before for the sacredness of their mission. On into Lebanon they walked, through Tripoli and the wildness of Beirut. They neared the Promised Land.
"Are there Jews here?"
The year was 1888. 40 months had passed since that night Yaakov and Yossi fled the Zhytomyr ghetto. Yossi had grown into a lean and leathery giant, 6 feet 3 inches tall with a frame of steel. He was 20 years of age and he wore a flaming red beard. Yaakov was 18 and also hardened by the more than 3 years of travel, but he was still of medium height with dark, sensitive features and was filled with the same intenseness he had had from childhood. They stood upon a hill. Below them was a valley. Yaakov and Yossi Rabinsky stared down at the Hula in northern Galilee. Yossi Rabinsky sat down upon a rock and wept. Their journey was over.
"But the Lord liveth," Yaakov said. which brought up and led the seed of the house of Israel out of the north country and from all the countries whither I had driven them, and they shall dwell in their own land.
Yaakov put his hand on Yossi's shoulder.
We are home, Yossi. We are home.
Chapter 5. From the hill they looked down onto the land. Across the valley in Lebanon rose the towering snow-capped peak of Mount Hermon. Below them stretched the Hulel Lake and marshes. There was an Arab village nestled in the hills to their right. Yossi Rabinsky experienced the greatest exultation he had ever known. How beautiful the promised land looked from here. He vowed to himself, as young men will at such times, that he would return some day, and from this very spot would look down on his very own land. They stayed there for a day and a night, and the next morning began the descent in the direction of the Arab village. The white-colored mud houses, clumped together in a saddle of the hill, were dazzling in the morning sun. The farmlands and olive orchards sloped from the village toward the swamp of the Hulel Lake. In the fields, a donkey pulled a wooden plowshare. Other donkeys carried small harvest upon their backs. In the vineyards, the Arab women labored among the grapes. The village was as it must have been 1,000 years before. The distant beauty of the village faded with each step they took nearer, and was soon replaced by an overwhelming stench. Suspicious eyes watched the brothers from the fields and the houses of the village as they entered the dirt street. Life moved in slow motion in the blistering sun. The road was filled with camel and donkey excrement. Swarms of giant flies engulfed the brothers. A lazy dog lay motionless in the water of the open sewer to cool himself. Veiled women ducked for cover into squalid one-room houses made of mud. Half the huts were in a state of near collapse and held a dozen or more people, as well as pigs, chickens, mules, and goats. The boys stopped at the village water well. Straight-backed girls balanced enormous urns of water on their heads, or were busy kneeling and scrubbing clothing and exchanging gossip. The appearance of the travelers brought immediate silence.
May we have some water? Yossi asked.
No one dared answer. Haltingly, they drew a bucket of water, splashed their faces, filled their canteens, and made off quickly. Further on, they came upon a dilapidated shack, which served as a coffee house. Listless men sat or lay around on the ground as their wives tilled the fields. Some played backgammon. The air was foul with the mixed aroma of thick coffee, tobacco, hashish smoke, and the vile odors of the rest of the village.
We would like directions, Yossi said.
After several moments, one of the Arabs pulled himself off the ground and bade them follow. He led them out of the main area to a stream. On the other side of the stream was a small mosque and a minaret. On their side was a nicely built stone house set in the shade, and near it a room which served as the village reception room. They were taken to the room, told to enter, and be seated. The high walls of the room were whitewashed and thick. Well-placed windows made it quite cool. A long bench ran around the walls. The bench was covered with bright pillows. On the walls hung an assortment of swords and trinkets and pictures of Arabs and visitors. At last a man in his mid-twenties entered. He was dressed in an ankle-length striped cloth coat and a white headdress with a black band. His appearance immediately indicated that he was someone of wealth.
I am Kamal, Mukhtar, of Abu Yashar, he said.
He clapped his ringed hands together and ordered fruit and coffee to be brought to the strangers. As his brothers went off to carry out the order, a cold half-silence pervaded the room as the village elders filed in one by one. To the boy's surprise, Kamal spoke some Hebrew.
The site of this village is the traditional burial place of Joshua, he told them. You see, Joshua is a Muslim prophet as well as a Hebrew warrior. Then, following the Arab custom of never asking a direct question, Kamal set out to find out who the visitors were and what their mission was. At last, he suggested that perhaps the boys were lost, for no Jews had ventured into the Hula before. Yossi explained that they had entered the country from the north and sought the nearest Jewish settlement. After another half hour of roundabout questions, Kamal seemed satisfied that the two Jews were not scouting for land in the area. Then Kamal seemed to relax a bit. He confided that he was not only the Mukhtar and owned all the land in Abu Yasha, but the spiritual leader as well, and the only literate person in the village. Yossi somehow liked this man. For what reason, he did not know. He told Kamal about their pilgrimage from Russia and their desire to settle down and farm in the Holy Land. When the last of the fruit had been eaten, Yossi asked his leave.
You will find Jews 30 kilometers south. You can walk the distance by nightfall if you stay on the road. The place is called Rosh Pina.
Rosh Pina? How exciting! He had heard the name many times in the Pale.
Rosh Pina is halfway between the Hule Lake and the Sea of Galilee. On the way you will pass a large tell. Beneath the tell lies the ancient city of Hazor. May God protect you on your journey.
The road took them past the fields of Abu Yasha and skirted the forbidding Hula swamplands. Yossi looked back over his shoulder. He could see the spot from which they had crossed earlier that day.
I'll be back, he said to himself. I know I'll be back.
At midday they came upon the large man-made hill Kamal had described. As they climbed upward, they realized that beneath them lay buried the ancient city of Hazor. Yossi was elated.
Do you realize that Joshua may have been standing on this very spot when he conquered the city from the Canaanites?
Yossi went about collecting bits of broken pottery which were strewn all about. Since his very first sight of the Holy Land, Yossi had been in such a state of joy that he was completely unaware of the bad mood that had been overtaking Yaakov. Yaakov did not want to spoil his brother's happiness, so he remained silent. But his sullenness grew by the minute. At dusk, they reached Rosh Pina, the cornerstone, the farthest northern settlement of Jews. Their arrival produced a great furor. In a small building which served as the meeting room, they were eagerly questioned. But it was 40 months since they had left Zhytomyr, and they could only say that the pogroms that had started in 1881 were getting progressively worse. Although both boys concealed their feelings, Rosh Pina was a terrible disappointment. Instead of flourishing farms, they found a run-down village. There were but a few dozen Jews living midst conditions not much better than those of the Arabs of Abu Yasha.
Sometimes I think it would have been better to have stayed in Russia,
one of the Bilus opined.
At least in the ghetto we were among Jews. We had books to read, music to hear, and people to speak to. There were women. Here, there is nothing.
But all those things we heard at the Lovers of Zion meetings, Yossi said.
Oh, yes, we were filled with ideals when we arrived. One soon loses them in this country. Look at it, so ruined that nothing can grow. What little we do have is stolen by the Bedouins, and the Turks take what the Bedouins leave. If I were you boys, I'd keep on going to Jaffa and get on the next boat to America.
An outlandish idea, Yossi thought.
If it were not for the charity of Rothschild, de Hirsch, and de Schumann, we would all have starved long ago.
They left Rosh Pina the next morning and set out to cross the hills to Tzfat. Tzfat was one of the four holy cities of the Jews. It sat on a beautiful cone-shaped hill at the entrance to the Hula area of the Galilee.
Here, Yossi thought, their dejection would soon fade, because here there were second, third, and fourth generation Jews who lived and studied the Kabbalah, the Book of Mystics. The shock of Rosh Pinah was repeated in Tzfat. They found a few hundred aged Jews who lived in study and from the alms of co-religionists around the world. They cared nothing about the rebirth of the house of Jacob, but wanted only to live quietly, studiously, and in poverty. The Rabinsky brothers set out again from Tzfat the next morning and crossed to nearby Mount Canaan and stopped to get their bearings. From Mount Canaan, the vista was magnificent. From here, they could look back at Tzfat on its cone-shaped hill and beyond it to the Sea of Galilee. To the north, they could see the rolling hills of the Hula from whence they had come. Yossi loved this view, for before him was the land he had first trod. Yes, he vowed again that someday it would be his. Yakov's bitterness began to show.
All our lives, all our prayers, and look at it, Yossi.
Yossi put his hand on his brother's shoulder.
Look how beautiful it appears from here, he said. I tell you, Yakov, someday we will make it look just as beautiful from the bottom of the hill as it does from the top.
I don't know what to believe anymore, Yakov whispered. All through those winters, as we walked through the mountains blue with cold, all through those blistering summers.
Yossi said, Now cheer up. Tomorrow we begin our journey to Yerushalayim.
Jerusalem. The magic word caused Yaakov's flagging spirits to soar. The next morning they came down from Mount Canaan and moved south along the Sea of